This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with attorney Flint Taylor about his recent article on the history of police unions in the United States.
Flint Taylor is perhaps the foremost litigator in America against police abuse. So when he says something about it, it's worth listening to.
We'll hear an excerpt from a speech by Stephen Saleta at New York University to a standing room only audience.
Saleta's firing, before he actually took a position with the American Indian Studies program at the University of Illinois, was one of the great defeats for those who support free speech and academic freedom on campuses. He's fighting back. Let's listen to what he has to say.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The New York Police Department Police Officers Union outrageous assertion that New York Mayor Bill Blasio had, quote, blood on his hands in the murder of the two New York Police Department officers is consistent with the reactionary role of police unions across the country. They came to prominence in the wake of the civil rights movement. Police unions have played a powerful role in resisting all manner of police reforms and in defending police officers, no matter how outrageous and racist their actions. We're joined today by Chicago attorney Flint Taylor, who's practiced law in that city with the People's Law Office for 45 years. He was one of the lawyers for the families of the slain Black Panther leader Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. He also represented many survivors of Chicago police torture and has done battle with the Chicago Police Department and their Fraternal Order of Police. He joins us today to discuss the reactionary role of police unions around the United States.
Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you. I'm always happy to be with you on this show. It's a great show.
And thanks for joining us live from City Hall in Chicago. I understand you're in a public space, so we appreciate that. We've just read your important article, Blood on Their Hands, The Racist History of Modern Police Unions, from In These Times. And I think that our listeners are so aware of the controversy between Patrick Lynch here in New York, the leader of the New York City Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, and Mayor de Blasio. So your article really gives a survey of the history of police unions in a number of metropolitan areas across the country. We wanted to start by hearing some specific examples from each city and then do a little analysis of why these unions are so dangerous and really don't comport with our notion of traditional unions. But could you start with giving us some history about the union in New York?
Well, I started to look at this because I have been in battle with the union in here in Chicago, the Federal Fraternal Order of Police, since I've been a lawyer, which has been almost 45 years now. And after I saw what was happening in New York, I did some research on New York, as well as brought back to memory a lot that had happened here in Chicago. So in my article, I focused on those two cities primarily. In New York, I took it all the way back to Mayor Lindsay when he attempted to deal with and bring about a civilian review agency of the police department there. And of course, the PBA, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, as they're called, went crazy around that and fought that and was able to keep that from happening. And then you can track it from there right to the present. And there are incidents and issues that I was able to find under several mayors. There was an issue that caused a police riot there in New York. And of course, each time it's focused on the Black community and people of color. One of the instances that the police showed their displeasure by running through the Black and community and banging on the top of garbage cans, waving their guns around, and Abe Beame had to go and get a restraining order to stop them. And the racism of it all became even more apparent under Mayor Dinkins's reign in the 90s, when he again revisited the idea of a of strengthening the civilian review agency or the disciplinary agency of the police department, and about 10,000 New York cops at the leadership of the PBA and the other unions, and I put quotes around the word unions, of course, came out again and rioted and had all these racist signs and that attacked Dinkins in a very racist way.
I was living in New York then, and I remember it, and they had cartoons of Dinkins with an exaggerated hairdo and thick lips, and they were chanting, as they marched in front of City Hall, they were chanting, "Dinkins is a washroom attendant." And this was the first and only black mayor of the city of New York, and this is what the cops, and not just the Policemen's Benevolent Association, but they've got an outfit that represents the sergeants, and they got another one that represents the captains, and they're out there chanting that in front of City Hall.
Right. And that's interesting that you were there, because, of course, I saw it as a piece of history. I vaguely remember hearing some of it out here all the way in Chicago. And then when the Mullen Commission came out with the findings about corruption in the police department and about brutality in the 90s, again, they made findings that the union was very powerful and that they were a major force in the corruption and the cover-up and of police brutality. And that came to fruition again in the Abner Louima case, where the union at that point and its officers not only defended the cops that did the brutal sexual assault on Abner Louima, but they were involved in a conspiracy to cover it all up and met with the officers involved. And some of the officers were connected to the, of course, as leaders in the union, that they actively came up with a false story in that case. So, yeah, the union just continues in New York. And, of course, Patrick Lynch was a mouthpiece back then in the late 90s. And, of course, he pops his ugly head up again in the Garner struggle and of course, with the outrageous statement about blood on your hands.
And, Flint, I think many people may not know that the PBA in New York is an active lobbyist in Albany and contributes to political campaigns. They wield great influence over the police department and are brought in for consultations on major decisions.
Yes, and that's what the Mullen Commission found back, 20 years ago. And I, of course, I'm sure that it continues to this day. And in Chicago, the union is very powerful as well, the Fraternal Order of Police. And sometimes you find that the union is to the right of the police hierarchy, believe it or not.
No, and that's absolutely a good point to make. I remember that in New York, when the issue came up, when we were arguing for community control of the police, and one of the suggestions was, well, police should live in the neighborhood that they patrol. It was the Policemen's Benevolent Association, with all their money, that lobbied in Albany and got a law passed saying that you can live anywhere. So the cops that patrol New York City, and particularly the minority communities, they live in Rockland County. They live out in Long Island. They don't live here. And when they get here, they're strangers and they're scared. And that's part of the explanation for their racist behavior.
Right, and I think that that what I found, not that I didn't already understand it, but when I put together the article and studied New York over the last 50 years, and as well as brought together all of my understanding here in Chicago, is that they're so fundamentally racist. They don't represent even all of the cops. They represent the white power structure of the police department, the most reactionary aspects of the department. And whenever there's racism or racism is at the heart of the police actions, you'll find the union right there, shoulder to shoulder, defending those actions by those cops. In Chicago, it started back around the Democratic Convention in 1968, the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the Black Panther leaders, and of course the union. The FOP became extremely actively involved in defending the indefensible in the John Birch police torture cases and has been at the heart of it here in Chicago for 20, 30 years with regard to resisting all forms of justice in the Burge torture cases.
Well, Flint, I wanted to ask you about that and ask you to give us some more details on what the cops have done in Chicago since the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. But I also wanted to point out your article covers other cities as well. You hopscotch around the country because this is a national phenomena. You talk about the police, quote, unions in Seattle, Los Angeles, Detroit, Milwaukee, and we could add Philadelphia, of course, because they've been active in trying to murder Mumia for 30 years and keep him in prison. I mean, this is a national phenomena. But let me ask you to give us some more detail about the Chicago example, because it really is quite amazing.
Well, I'll focus it right now on what they did in the Burge cases. Burge, of course, tortured over 120 African-American men in the station house on the south and west sides of Chicago to get false confessions from them. And as that came unglued, and I was one of the lawyers involved in fighting those cases back in the 80s and 90s, the union defended Burge, and they defended him first when he was unceremoniously fired after all of this evidence came to light, and right after he was fired by the police department in the mid-90s, the union had the temerity to organize a float to honor Burge and the two other officers who also were found to have tortured in the very well-attended by politicians and other Irish luminaries in the city, that being the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And they were going to have a float honoring the officer who had just been fired for torturing black people. That caused quite a ruckus in the city, and they had to withdraw that float. Just previous to that, as we were uncovering this evidence, they organized a little subcommittee called the Burge, Eusitis, and O'Hara. Those were the three officers involved, committee, family fund committee. And they took off not only defending Burge, but attacking us, claiming that we made up all of the evidence of torture over the years, that we were in it only for the money, and basically tried to totally discredit us and the victims of police torture. So they had a rich record of this kind of racist activity with regard to Burge, and they continued it when Burge was indicted here for perjury and obstruction of justice in the mid-2000s, and gave him free lawyers, as they did with regard to his firing proceedings, and pushed through not the rank and file, never got to vote on it, but pushed through defending him. I should say his pension was not taken away. They attempted to take it away, but by a 4-4 vote, they upheld his pension, even though he was in the penitentiary, and they supplied the lawyers to defend that all the way to the Illinois Supreme Court. So the union here, again, is the white officers union, and not only that, but it's not the white officers union. It represents the racist interests of a certain clique of police officers who, of course, patrol the communities of color here in Chicago.
Flint, do you know much about where these unions get their money from? I know many of them have vast resources that they can devote to either lobbying or launching campaigns across the country. Are they supported just by the members?
That would be a good thing to look into. I really haven't looked into that. If you think about it, what, New York has 30,000 cops.
35,000.
35.
Like an army.
Chicago has 13,000. And it's mandatory, I think. I don't think you can opt out of paying dues. And you have, you know, it's totally anti-democratic, but I would imagine they probably have some benefactors as well that help to keep their coffers even more full than just what the dues might be and whatever fundraising. Now, another thing they did for Burge during that era in the 90s, just before the float and while he was on trial in front of the Chicago Police Board, was they had a big fundraiser for him, where 3,000 or 4,000 cops and a good number of prosecutors showed up to honor the guy who was being prosecuted for torturing African-American men. here in the city. So they always are on the side of reaction. And as I said in my article, they totally support the concept of the reality that the police are an occupying force in the communities of color across this nation. And unless there's a fundamental change in policing and in the justice system, the union is going to have that kind of power and is going to continue to flank on the right what is already a reactionary military force, which is the police department.
We're speaking with Attorney Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office in Chicago. Flint has recently written an excellent article, which I commend to our listeners, called Blood on Their Hands, The Racist History of Police Unions. And Flint, in your article, you kind of hopscotch around the country because it's just not New York and Chicago, and you gave examples from many other cities as well. And I wanted you to explain some of the actions of these, quote, unions in other cities outside of the two major cities in the country.
Sure. You know, I didn't have the time to do the research. Would have really been exhaustive in terms of other cities. But with Los Angeles, of course, we had during the Rodney King cases, or both in state court and later in federal court, after, of course, Rodney King, the video showed that he was brutally beaten by LAPD officers, the union came out strongly against the African-American mayor there, Tom Bradley, who was incensed by the fact that basically an all-white jury in Simi County acquitted the officers in the first trial, in the state trial. And he said, no officers who did what I saw on videotape should serve on the LAPD. Well, that incensed, I think it's called the LA Protective League. I don't remember exactly what they're called out there. But they were basically ballistic on that and campaigned against Bradley for years. In Detroit, Coleman Young, another African-American mayor in the 70s, was dealing with police brutality as part of the racist nature of the system there, and he was trying to reform all of that. And that led to a lawsuit by the union out there, up there. And when they lost that, they decided to take to the streets. And instead of beating demonstrators' heads, they were the demonstrators. And they were showing the same kind of violence that they are supposedly supposed to quell. In Seattle, there was a case recently. There was a progressive mayor there. I think his name was McGinn. And he spoke out when a Native American man was killed by the police, apparently unjustifiably. And the cop was fired, I believe. And the mayor had the temerity to say something like, we don't want people on our force who don't subscribe to racial equality and racial justice. And the union basically said, you shouldn't be imposing your views on the police department, as if that was, and they did a nutty on that. I'm sure that if we looked at other cities, which, as I said, I didn't have a chance to. You mentioned Philadelphia. Someone sent me an article about what was going on in another city. So yes, it's basically universal. I think even more so in the big urban areas, the big cities.
In response to the killing of two New York City police officers a month ago, we saw what I thought was an unprecedented response of officers flying in from all around the country, the airlines giving them free flights to come to the funerals. Do you think that would have happened had our mayor not said that he cautioned his son to be careful during encounters with law enforcement on the streets? Do you think that was a reaction to de Blasio? Or do we always see that kind of turnout?
Oh, we don't always see that. Obviously, it's a big deal in certain aspects of a city's life and politics when an officer is killed. The difference between the reaction, official reaction, when an officer is killed and when a poor black person or a person of color killed on the street is remarkable and points to the disparities involved. But yeah, I think that what de Blasio said, he had the audacity to actually talk about his own child as a potential victim of police violence, that really riled them up. And I would say also that when I was looking at doing this article, I ran across the fact that the Chicago FOP had on its website request, or you could donate to the Darren Wilson, of course, the cop that killed Michael Brown, you could donate to his defense fund through the FOP here in Chicago. So, yeah, they have their own networking, obviously, and it not only deals with those who are on the force and who are in the unions, but they have all their alumni. They have their little think tanks, just like the government does, the police foundation. And whenever the police want to get, quote, an opinion that they can use in court from someone, they go to the police foundation or other type of agencies where former cops and police officials populate. And you see, of course, the former chief in Boston, Davis. Now he's a commentator on TV. And so, you know, that whole culture is promoted. And when cops are killed, and I'm certainly not condoning that, the reaction is totally different and extreme.
Well, Flint, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to get to a discussion with you on what to do about it, because these are not unions in the traditional sense of the word of working people coming together to better their lives. These are outfits that essentially support the 1%. They're not out there really to stop crime. I mean, in New York, after the de Blasio statement and the cops' reaction to it, the cops went on strike in New York. They weren't issuing tickets, particularly out in Staten Island. And the rate of crime didn't go up. So what's the moral? You really don't need them. Well, you do need them if you're the 1%. That's when you need them. But what I wanted to ask you was, what do we do about it? You've had some successes in your career, and there have been some times when we've been able to make some progress here. How do we go forward, you know, against that wall of blue reaction?
Well, if you're talking specifically about, you know, police unions, I think that we have to resist them in the same way we resist the police department, and we have to educate. We have to bring forward the issue of who these unions are and who they represent. I mean, in the sense, and we have to educate our brothers and sisters in the broader labor unions, like the SEIU and the unions that support and have amongst their members the correctional officers and that kind of thing. And you know, I think it's because the union membership is shrinking in this country, that public unions are becoming more important. And public unions, now are we talking about police? I mean, the police unions reflect police departments. Police departments are occupying forces. They were created to put down the working class. They were created to protect, as you say, the interests of what is now the 1%. So how can they be part of the union? How can they be part of the movement that deals for workers' rights and deals and fights against racism, when that's what they're defending? So I think that has to be not only discussed, but what they do and why they do it has to be exposed. And we have to, as people who are concerned with the movement and with the kinds of issues that we fight all the time, we have to understand the union's role, the police union's role in that as a reactionary force.
Flint, you start off your article talking about this police unions as a consequence of the civil rights movement. And I'd like to kind of wind up our discussion with your observations on the timing of all of that.
Well, you know, again, I'm not a historian per se, and I suppose I could be proven wrong. But when I started to look at all of this, I got the impression that the strength of these unions started in the 60s. And of course, the movement had moved to the north in the civil rights movement, places like New York and Chicago, and the Black Panthers were becoming strong across the country, and the fight for civilian control of police was becoming an important issue. So issues that the union, it seems to me, and also affirmative action in Chicago was another important fight that was being fought by black officers here, affirmative action in the police department. So the union became strong as a countervailing force for all kinds of progressive activities that, to me, seem to arise out of the movement, and at least in the modern era, to arise out of the civil rights movement as it particularly came to the northern cities here in this country. So that's where, when I track the history of it, that's where I came to. I don't really know what, if any, history there is of police unions that predate, let's say, the 60s. I really didn't look for that, but I didn't come across the fact that they were particularly strong in any era before that time.
Flint, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I just wanted to read for our listeners your last sentence, because I think it beautifully condenses the essence of your research. You write that police unions further the all-too-accurate conception that the police are an occupying force in poor communities of color and are antithetical in principle and action to the progressive principles of the labor movement. This is a beautiful article, very important, and as usual, we value your insights.
It's called Blood on Their Hands, The Racist History of Police Unions by Flint Taylor.
Thanks for joining us, Flint.
My pleasure, and I always am happy to talk with both of you.
Thank you, Flint.
Take care. Good luck.
All right, take care now.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. Archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Professor Stephen Salida, at age 39, had already written 6 outstanding books. He was a tenured professor at Virginia Tech University. He was offered a job with tenure at the University of Illinois in their American Indian Studies program. He accepted the job, quit his other job, left his house. His wife did the same, left her job. They were en route to Illinois for him to start working, when he was told by Chancellor Phyllis Wise at the University of Illinois that he was not going to be hired. He was fired from a tenured job he had been offered at the University of Illinois because of his tweets criticizing Israel's murderous war on the people of Gaza last summer. Why? Because the university was under tremendous pressure, as documentary evidence shows, by private donors who said, "You hire Salida, we won't give you money." The university caved. Salida didn't get his job. He's now out of work, and he's about to file, or will have filed, a lawsuit trying to get his job back and reassert the principles of academic freedom, academic shared government, and free speech. Today we hear a speech by Stephen Salida at New York University, given the latter part of November when he was in town, speaking out in his own defense.
I'll try to move through this quickly because I know there are so many people in uncomfortable positions, and an extra chair just opened up here. Really, honestly, if somebody wants to grab it. Thank you for coming. I'm overwhelmed by the kindness and the support. And before I get started, a qualification. I'm well aware that the Israel-Palestine conflict is controversial. Believe me, I'm well aware. Extremely aware. I have strong views about the conflict, but feel confident that my perspectives are grounded in a preponderance of evidence. Even if we agree on evidence, though, and I'm sure we don't, there are dozens, maybe hundreds of moral options available to us in the arenas of interpretation and action. I didn't come to argue or provoke, but to discuss, so I welcome your reactions and questions, and I'll do my best to answer them as honestly as possible. With the term internationalism, with the backslash between inter and nationalism, I emphasize communalism and dialogue across borders, both natural and geopolitical, not the nationalism of the nation state, but of the nation itself, as composed of heterogeneous communities functioning as self-identified collectives attached to particular land bases. Internationalism is a way to compare nationalisms, to put them into conversation, but also to examine how the invention and evolution of national identities necessarily rely on an international dialectics. Internationalism encourages and assesses the play of decolonial narratives across cultures and colonial borders. I divide the term with the slash to reflect not just the political, philosophical, and ethical dialogue intimated by the prefix inter, but also to separate nationalism from the prefix while keeping the two halves connected in such a way that they create more possibilities in juxtaposition. Internationalism expresses a desire for scholarship to explore broader patterns of discourse and power in our analyses of specific communities, and a commitment to the project of nation building through deep engagement with decolonial paradigms. I want to talk about Palestine as it relates to notions of indigeneity in North America. In order to do this, it's useful to think about the place of Palestine in the American imagination. I mean three things by imagination, though the term lends itself to infinite possibilities. One, how Palestine has been imagined in American discourses since the early days of European settlement. That is to say, how it has been invented as a mythological space based largely on the desires of the American polity. Two, how Palestine, in its biblical incarnations, provided early settlers an ideal of nationhood that continues to influence American identity and even its foreign policy. And three, how Palestine has been constructed by American politicians and commentators as a site of intractable struggle, a symbol of a particular sort of pre-modernity that creates anxiety around the inability of the American ideal to fully come to fruition. I would argue that Palestine has been as crucial to the making of America, itself a contested and inconsistent space, as any other landscape, including those in Africa that provided slave labor and the nostalgic reconstruction of the mother countries, England, Germany, Italy, Ireland, and so forth. In other words, although the United States has been embroiled in Palestine only recently, within the past 100 years, Palestine as a myth and an avatar informs the groundwork of the American project. Palestine is the progenitor of manifest destiny. Here's a passage from Puritan firebrand Cotton Mather, speaking in the early 18th century. "Turn not your back till they are consumed. Wound them that they shall not be able to arise. And for a close, let me remind you that while you fight, we'll pray. We will keep the mount with our hands lifted up. While you are in the field with your lives in your hands against the Amalek that is now annoying this Israel in the wilderness. The pronoun they refers to the native tribes Mather wanted exterminated, as was the indigenous population of the Holy Land, on orders from God, as recorded in the Old Testament's book of Joshua. Amalek, of course, is a reference to the land of Canaan and its environs, occupied by numerous tribes. So Mather, like other Puritans, superimposes a biblical narrative onto the American landscape. The settlers are Israel in the wilderness. The natives are godless souls, Canaanites, Amalekites, Jebusites, Hittites, and others who must be removed or slaughtered in order for a godly vision to prevail. In one sense, Mather's discourse is an allegory. In a very real way, though, he was being literal in describing his circumstances as a New World settler. Mather, by the way, famously referred to natives as the accursed seed of Canaan. Israel currently occupies the Palestinian West Bank and Syrian Golan Heights in contravention of international law. It exerts full control over the Gaza Strip. At various points in its history, it occupied the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula and southern Lebanon. Some say it still does, and I'd also point out that it continues to occupy 1948 Palestine. West Bank Palestinians are subject to a set of discriminatory laws. Palestinian citizens of Israel are also subject to a set of discriminatory laws. Israel's military occupation is illegal according to international law and various human rights conventions. Israel displaced around 700,000 Palestinians during the period of its founding, 1947 to 1949. Israel killed over 500 children during Operation Protective Edge, its recent attack on Gaza. Israel considers itself a state for all Jews anywhere in the world, rather than one for all of its actual citizens. Israel is the sole nuclear power in the Middle East. Israel received $3 billion in annual aid from the United States, not including weapons shipments and loan guarantees. There is unassailable documentary evidence that from the earliest days of Zionism, its leaders intended to cleanse the native Arab population from Palestine. Now, I selected these facts from a Rolodex of possibilities. Anybody can pick and choose issues to supplement or create a particular story. So facts are never indicators of truth in and of themselves. From the Palestinian point of view, though, these issues are crucial. They comprise the historical circumstances by which Palestinians have been dispossessed. I also highlight them as a counterpoint to modern Palestine in the American imagination. As in the past, Palestine is a symbol. For many, it is an avatar of barbaric Arab and Muslim violence, a key battleground in the global war on terror. For others, it is a space of courageous resistance. On the political left especially, Palestine has become a metaphor of liberatory struggle, the site of a new third world movement against Western imperialism. For others still, it is a confounding example of tribal or religious intractability. Palestine exists along or creates numerous fault lines in American political discourse. In many ways, Israel is a fuller realization of the American dream. Palestine, on the other hand, is an anxiety, one whose existence ensures the presence of the native. It is also a geography where myth and matter converge. To put it simply, even though there are clearly geopolitical implications in Israel and Palestine for the United States, Americans are engaged in the so-called Holy Land for reasons that go far beyond geopolitics. In turn, arguments about the Israel-Palestine conflict can be messy. I consider myself kind of, sort of young, but I'm already a veteran of those arguments. And I'm aware that people feel deeply invested. They feel invested because the conflict is a matter of identity just as much as it is of geography and economics. Yet, I'd like to propose that Israel-Palestine is no more intense or unusual than any other violent conflict over land. We confer to it an exceptional status, but when we remove the mythology, which admittedly is hard to do, it's just another case of settler colonization, not terribly unlike what happened in North America, Algeria, South Africa, New Zealand, and Australia. The conflict is easily understood and has a straightforward solution. It began because one group of people forcibly settled the land of another group of people. Its solution is to stop the colonization and implement a system of democracy for all citizens rather than a tiered system of access and belonging based on religious background. A solution is complex or impossible only for those invested in the illegal occupation of Palestine and the structural iniquities it produces. It's also so complex and impossible because in the United States, settlement is seen as normative, inevitable, and irreversible. I can't count the times I've heard some variation of the following argument. Look, the dispossession of Palestinians, they even say it like that. Look, you know, the dispossession of Palestinians happened, and as tragic as it was, we're all better off because of it. Look at the United States. It had to displace Indians to create the world's greatest democracy. Trademark, you know, you have to put the trademark around world's greatest democracy, right? So should the United States return stolen land to the Indians? You've all heard that argument, right? You hear that argument all the time. Well, it's an inadequate argument, right, for historical and moral reasons. The idea behind it is that you can't reverse history. But such a notion can only be put forward by the victor, who, after all, spent plenty of time reversing history in order to accrue his power. In fact, I would suggest that this isn't an argument. It's an evasion. Leaving that aside, the most important thing about this logic is what it tells us about ourselves, what it says about our acceptance, if only unconsciously, of profound violence in the service of democracy. The question, should the United States return stolen land to the Indians, is rhetorical, of course. The answer is embedded in the question. Of course not! Don't be absurd! And the correlation is that it would be absurd for Israel to do the same to Palestinians. It's a type of mutual delegitimization of native populations. But the question can't function in isolation. It relies on a sweep of history that illuminates how crucial the mythologies of Palestine are to the American imagination. Israeli historian Benny Morris puts it this way, and just to be extremely clear, I'm quoting, because I never, ever, ever want my words confused with Benny Morris's. Even the great American democracy couldn't come to be without the forced extinction of Native Americans. There are times the overall final good justifies terrible, cruel deeds. So I quoted this Morris passage in an article I wrote some time ago for Salon, and Morris ended up having a conniption about it. He was like all over the editors and all over me because he says I misquoted him, and of course I hadn't misquoted him. You know, I promptly found like about 25 different credible websites that show Morris making the point. He still felt the need to clarify, and so he emailed me a clarification of what he really meant by the quote, and I wish I had it with me. It's in my archive. I really need to print it out and start reading it, because his justification for the quote was even worse than the quote itself. You know, just, you know, his shovel was just moving so rapidly, and it shows that he can't sort of conceptualize an idea outside of this particular framework. But his reasoning suggests a finality to the past, an affirmation of tragedy trapped in the immutability of linear time. Its logic is terribly cliché, a peculiar form of common sense always taken up everywhere by the beneficiaries of colonial power. The problems with invoking native genocide to rationalize Palestinian dispossession are extraordinary. The most noteworthy problem speaks to the unresolved detritus of American history. Natives aren't objects of the past. They are living communities whose numbers are growing. It's rarely a good idea to ask rhetorical questions that have literal answers. Yes, the United States absolutely should return stolen land to the Indians. That's precisely what its treaty obligations require it to do. The United States is a settler nation, but its history hasn't been settled. Yet most people invoke natives as if they lost a contest that entrapped them in the past. And this only if natives are considered at all. As a result, most analyses of both domestic and foreign policies are inadequate, lacking a necessary context of continued colonization and resistance. For natives, political aspirations aren't focused on accessing the mythologies of a multicultural America, but on the practices of sovereignty and self-determination, consecrated in treaty agreements, and of course in their own histories. Treaties aren't guidelines or suggestions. They are nation-to-nation agreements whose stipulations exist in perpetuity. That the federal government still ignores so many of those agreements indicates that colonization isn't simply an American memory. One of the most famous violations is the Treaty of Fort Laramie, 1851 and 1868, which guaranteed the Lakota possession of the Black Hills. The American government seized the Black Hills 9 years after signing the treaty in 1877, having discovered sizable deposits of gold and other precious minerals. In 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the federal government had unjustly appropriated the Black Hills, and by appropriated, they really mean stole. The court awarded the Lakota $15.5 million, now well over $100 million with inflation, for the adjusted value of the appropriated land, but the tribe has consistently refused the monetary settlement, preferring instead to retain entitlement to its historical territory, and holy territory, I should add. So to clarify, vast portions of 5 U.S. states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Wyoming, and Montana, are Indian land according to a treaty to which the American government voluntarily assented. The highest legal authority in the United States has acknowledged that a significant portion of the land in question is rightfully Lakota. The American government refuses to return the land. A comparable example of continuing U.S. colonization, and unfortunately this could go on for a while, right? We could be here at the same time tomorrow, sort of listing the ways that the U.S. government has engaged in some sort of mendacity vis-a-vis indigenous communities. But a comparable example exists in Hawaii, the youngest American state. Hawaii became an American possession in 1893 due to a coup d'etat led by colonist Sanford Dole, cousin of James Dole, who, not so coincidentally, made a fortune growing produce on the islands. President Grover Cleveland commissioned an investigation into the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy led by Georgia Congressman James Henderson Blunt. The Blunt Report condemned the annexation. The condemnation ultimately did no good. American businessmen and politicians saw too much value in the new property to constrain their avarice. To this day, the Kanaka Maoli, the native Hawaiians, do not recognize the legitimacy of the annexation and consider themselves subjects of foreign rule. While American tourists enjoy hula dances and Mai Tais on stolen land, the Kanaka Maoli, victims of a conquest that in no way has passed, continue to organize for liberation. Colonialism is present across North America in less obvious ways, though the lack of obviousness doesn't mitigate its relevance. Corporate malfeasance is especially harmful to indigenous communities in the Americas and across the world. Native nations have dealt with an uninterrupted expropriation of resources for over a century and now experience an inordinate amount of disease and pollution. At present, natives and their allies in both Canada and the U.S. are working to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, a project that portends environmental damage and serious health concerns. Natives have encountered violence in attempting to exercise their hunting and fishing rights. Those of us of a certain age, and yes, I'm of this age, probably remember bumper stickers, especially if you spend any time in the Midwest. Save a fish, spear an Indian, right? Or the even worse version, save a fish, spear a squaw. People used to put in their bumper stickers and drive around with it. Police brutality is acute in Indian country. Natives, women especially, are murdered at an epidemic rate, with the majority of cases unresolved. And many communities are still waiting on various institutions to comply with federal legislation requiring the return of artifacts and human remains to their rightful owners. Nor should we forget that the forced sterilization of Native women and the kidnapping of children to be educated, that is, brutally assimilated, in government boarding schools, where many were sexually molested and subject to countless other abuses, were still happening within the past half century. And here I'll take a moment to highlight the fact that Israel was caught recently red-handed, forcibly sterilizing African women. The inveterate omission of these realities in analyses of American politics constitutes an erasure of indigenous histories and illuminates why it is so easy to conceptualize the United States as historically settled. If we recall the existence of dynamic Indian nations, though, we have no choice but to rethink the commonplaces of American virtue. It is a foolish conceit to suggest that history has ended in the United States. No amount of ignorance, willful or unwilling, will invalidate the vigorous efforts to decolonize the North and South American continents. When Israel's supporters invoke the dispossession of living communities on those continents as a rationale for colonizing Palestine, they betray a profound disdain of indigenous humanity, the sort of contempt that renders the oppressor's psyche so unsettled. Finally, allow me to take a moment to explore the question of academic freedom in the context of what I've been saying. I know that's on a lot of people's minds. And everything I've discussed contextualizes my situation with the University of Illinois. More than mere context, I would say that everything I've discussed has come to a head with my firing from UIUC, an event that's become a flashpoint for numerous issues and frustrations. I was hired to teach in the American Indian Studies program, a crucial fact that too often is overlooked. It's crucial because my termination isn't simply a personal problem, but an attack on the fields of American Indian and Indigenous Studies, and the humanities and social sciences more broadly. That university administrators deployed the language of civility to justify their actions illuminates a model of governance deeply rooted in colonial ethos. Civility exists in the lexicon of conquest. It is the language of Cotton Mather's diatribes. It is the discourse of educated racism. It is the sanctimony of the authoritarian. It is the pretext of the oppressor. It tells us that American Indian Studies, and indigenous scholars require special oversight, one that contravenes the legal and historical conventions of university governance. It is a tragic allegory of a centuries-old federal Indian policy, or perhaps a meta-narrative more than an allegory. The profound delegitimization of American Indian studies at Illinois cannot be underestimated. To support Palestine in the American polity automatically entails an act of radicalism, no matter how measured or demonstrable the point of view. It is necessarily uncivil, no matter how polite the appeal. To raise this support in context of Native peoples is doubly threatening and requires a special administrative dispensation. It recalls periods of American history that supposedly have ended, that have no place in the modern consciousness. It would be a great mistake to conceptualize my termination as having much to do with me beyond the unpredictability of chance. I and the university at this point are merely protagonists in a broader contest about how our universities will function in the future. They can continue to be neoliberal corporations, or they can reclaim their status as sites of actual education. We're all entrapped by the history of civility as a rationale for violence and a rhetorical device to neatly separate the modern from the savage. Throughout this history, academic freedom has never been a panacea. African Americans have never fully received its protections. In too many instances, they have been antagonized or brutalized by the pieties of objectivity. The same is true of indigenous peoples, or of any deviant body or body of deviant ideas. Adjunct faculty have no functional academic freedom. Upper administrators aren't simply swelling the ranks of the contingent to save money. They desire a workforce that can be expendable and easily punished if that's what the political winds demand. Of course, this is all about civility. Civility is not a state of mind. It is a regime. Civility reinforces the conceits of modernity. Academic freedom is a function of modernity. It will therefore always have difficulty accommodating systematic critique of state power. No state attaches more power to the stature of its identity than Israel. The United States is inseparable from Israeli power. This is the context of my situation with the University of Illinois. There's a semiotics of disputation at play here. Folks feel invested in the outcome of this situation because its implications inform the corporatization of academe and the erosion of democratic governing practices on campus. The images of Palestine in the American imagination facilitate this decline of democracy. The continued occupation of Native American lands means that the democracy never fulfilled its own self-image. The University of Illinois administration maligned Native America and Palestine simultaneously. It did so by again conferring normativity to the commonsensical exercise of U.S. and Israeli state power. It requires a deeply civilized mind to accomplish all these things in so short a time without the faintest hint of self-awareness. Obliviousness, anyway, is how civility survives. The most consistent forms of violence in this world are the ones explained away as natural human behavior. There's nothing more natural than our godly responsibility to perpetually renew the purity of the American landscape. And thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.